This is the first time I've been back in a law school for about 15 years. So it's a real treat for me to be back here. And the first time actually I've been back to the University of Virginia Law School, I think a little about 20 times. I was here, I think, once for a softball tournament. So I'm happy to be back for a more serious and sober in all its facets. The topic that I'm going to talk about is the state of American journalism. And by American journalism, I mean something very, very specific. That is fact-based reporting. There's a lot in media that falls under the rubric of news information. I'm talking about sort of the industry, the people, the reporters and editors who are the heart and soul, and have been the heart and soul of American journalism for a couple centuries. Those who go out in the field to report and come back and try to provide the most balanced and straightforward news and information that is really, I think, a building block of American democracy. And whenever I think of, when I ever sort of put sort of a self-serious title, something like the state of American journalism on a talk, I sort of think of like the state of the union. The president gets up and says, the state of the union is strong, and everyone stands in tears. But apropos sort of the time, more generally in this country, I have to report to you sort of the state of American journalism is terrible. And this is, we are in probably the most difficult and challenging time for American journalism in this country's history. And that, and by that I don't mean necessarily sort of a critique of reporters and editors. We can have that discussion. But I really mean that sort of business environment, the use environment has changed so much that the American, sort of American journalism industry is in free fall. Let me sort of tell you a little bit sort of, let me dazzle you with a few facts and figures. At the beginning of the decade, there were probably about 50,000 working journalists in newsrooms around the country. Radio, television, but mostly print. And for 150 years, journalism has been about newspapers. There's been a whole system of how reporters get into the business. They go work for a small town newspaper. They do well, they go to a mid-market newspaper. If they do really well, they end up at the Washington Post and New York Times. If they do really well, they sit next to George Stephanopoulos on This Week. I mean, that is sort of the hierarchy, the career ladder. That doesn't exist anymore because the American newspaper industry has fallen apart. There were 50,000 working journalists in the country at the beginning of the decade. It's about 35,000 now, and there'll probably be 5,000 less by the end of this decade. And that's a real collapse, and that comes from what has happened in the American newspaper industry, which results from really two things. One is people don't read newspapers anymore. 55% of Americans at the beginning of the decade read newspapers. Now it's down to about 45%. And it's even less with younger audiences. It probably reflects your own experience. It was about 45% who read daily newspapers at the beginning of the decade. It's now about 30%. All the usage has gone to the internet. So that's one phenomenon, which is people read newspapers less, they read magazines less, and that's had consequences for the business of newspapers. The other thing, of course, is advertisers have fled from newspapers, they've gone elsewhere. The heart and soul of newspaper economics used to be the classified ads or the job ad. But now, when I looked about 10 years ago, when we wanted renters for our house in Washington, we only had one thought in mind, putting that in the classified ad in the Washington Post. If I did that today, I would have only one thought in mind, put it on Craigslist. Those things, and the same is for jobs, used to go to newspapers, now you go to Monster or Career Builder or any one of the variety of other internet services. And those have really sort of taken out the legs of the American newspaper industry. And the consequence of this is fairly serious. The loss of jobs, loss of readership. 23 of the top 25 newspapers lost readership last year. Newsrooms are gone. There used to be about 25 American newspapers that had significant bureaus overseas. They're now two. And I think a lot of this is not just about sort of job preservation, but a lot of knowledge we have as a country. A lot of the information that goes into democratic dialogue comes from working journalists. And I've always thought one of the challenges we've had as a country with our our adventures overseas because sort of our splendid isolation. That used to be meant, I used to mean that in geographic terms when people talked about splendid isolation. Now I think we think about it in information terms. We don't know, we're not engaged in the rest of the world. Our newspapers, our journalists, they're not overseas, they're not engaged in the rest of the world. I think that has consequences for us as a country and how we evolve ourselves overseas. Really quite an extraordinary time. The challenge, I think, as newspapers constrict, as radio stations constrict, it's felt in a lot of different ways. It's felt coverage overseas. It's felt most clearly in small markets. How do you find out about what's going on in your town council? How do you find out what's going on in communities? The town newspapers, which used to be sort of the center of that information, are really gone. I mean, I actually opened up your local Charlottesville newspaper today. And most of the vast majority of stories were wire copy from AP or from Washington Post News Service. And that's, I think, something we need to think about as a country, about what's going to replace it, how we can have our news and information. The irony, of course, is that for many working journals right now, that their content's actually seen and heard by many more people than ever before. The New York Times has about 900,000 readers for the print edition, but it has about 15 million for its online edition. So there's much more usage, but these organizations as companies, I mean, I think the book talks a lot of this about sort of business and journalism, don't have the ability to make money off of their online services in the same way they did for their print edition. And that has led to this sort of extraordinary constriction and change in what change in how we get information. I'm sure you're all used, you know, I think it's actually what I'd love to talk with you all about during sort of the Q&A, sort of how you think about news information, how you get it now and in the future. But I think in this context, I know everyone comes to the University of Virginia and sort of quotes, or in my case, misquotes Mr. Jefferson. But you know, one of the things he said is, I certainly prefer newspapers without government than government without newspapers. And I think that's sort of the world we're getting to now, is government without newspapers, without journalists, without the checks and balances that are part of the traditional role of newspapers as a force of state. I spent a lot of time now, since I left NPR, thinking about sort of where the future of media is going to go, what's going to replace sort of the traditional roles of newspapers and journalists. I think there are actually sort of four possibilities that I want to offer out to you as what may happen in the future. No one knows, maybe all of them, and maybe none of them, and maybe some combination of them. One, of course, which is the existing sort of legacy organizations that are struggling will rethink themselves, rethink their business models. Christian Science Monitor became the first sort of daily newspaper to give up the print edition. They decided, really within the last few months, that they will be an online-only only organization that has challenges on the revenue side, but has a lot of savings on the expense side. A lot of these organizations live through sort of the printing press legacy, and they may be the forerunner of news organizations that really are rethinking themselves in the digital age. There are others that I think perhaps sort of you might think of as traditional news organizations that are growing up as digital-only organizations. The Politico, which I assume many of you know and many of you use, is a great example of a news organization that was really born in the digital age and really thinks of itself, as, although it has a print edition, it's really subsidiary and secondary to what they do online. And it may be that ultimately the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, if they survive, will rethink themselves and rethink their economics as purely digital plays in the long run. So I think that's one real possibility. The second is, I think interesting to think about, and there was a, and many of you got to pursue that, so it's something I've thought about a lot over the years, which is to rethink of journalism as a not-for-profit enterprise. I, of course, come from sort of this tiny little segment of the industry of not-for-profit journalism at NPR, but an age in which advertising dollars don't seem to support the business of journalism, can journalism rethink itself as a not-for-profit enterprise? And there are actually a whole series of startups that are starting, that are trying to fill sort of the vacuum of American journalism that are being supported by donors, large and small. There's a Paul Stryker, the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, has launched something called ProPublica, an independent investigative journalism nonprofit in New York. Done some work with 60 Minutes, actually about my former employer, the Voice of America. It all comes back around. A lot of the vacuum, a lot of our small organizations are trying to think about how to fill the vacuum of local news and start local, locally oriented news reporting organizations that are donor supported. A lot of former reporters at the Minnesota newspapers have just launched something in Minneapolis, San Diego. So that's a real movement to think about, so especially about community reporting, and it comes as sort of a public service rather than a for-profit model. The third thing that I think about, I spend a lot of time about these days, is sort of community and how journalism will be developed, how to use social media, Web 2.0 tools, Wikipedia, citizen journalism, how much of that will replace as sort of the professional cadre of reporters shrink. Do people fill in the gaps? Do the audience at city council meetings become the reporters of the future? And there have been really some interesting examples of citizen journalism in this campaign that I think are hallmarks of the future. In fact, some of the thing that actually came closest, the one incident, at least in my mind, wasn't Bill Ayers or Reverend Wright that came close to sinking President-elect Obama, but was his remarks he made at a fundraiser in San Francisco about the frustrations of average Americans that rely on religion. And that was actually recorded by a citizen journalist working with the Huffington Post, who was sort of a volunteer. She actually did this particular citizen journalist actually did a couple things that really had actually not in the end a determinative impact on the election, but really actually affected the course of the dialogue about the election for quite a period of time. So I think there is, you know, the question of whether the journalism core, the reporter core, is now 35,000 reporters, or is it really hundreds of thousands of people that have an interest every day in sort of what is news, what's going on, and sharing that information with their communities, either communities of geographies or community of interest. And the final thing, which hasn't started, but I've always wondered whether it will start, is actually sort of the return to the roots of American journalism. The American newspaper started not as sort of the independent voice of independent nonpartisan voice. They all started as rags of political parties, essentially house organs of the political parties and the local parties of the day. And that went on really through the mid to late 1800s. The idea of sort of nonpartisan journalism is really an invention of the 20th century, and we may be seeing its death in the 21st century. And I've also, and I think we've begun to see little echoes as political parties and interest groups of all types begin to see themselves having not to work through the intermediaries of newspapers or radio stations or broadcasters, but actually have direct avenues to the public. And whether they begin to rethink themselves as news organizations, as fact providers. I mean, the Obama campaign, actually, though it never went the step so far, really had the biggest broadcast megaphone in the country for almost a year. And they used to focus that on his campaign, but it's only a small step, and I think a potential step. Those organizations and interest groups need to think of themselves as sort of critical organizations in the news and information chain, begin to think themselves as sort of the journalists of the future. That is actually a return to the real roots of American journalism. And I think we will end up debating as a country whether that's the right way to think about the future in journalism. It is interesting for me now as an old guy, I sit on one side of the digital divide, to come back here and actually talk with you all about how you think about news and information. I come from sort of a legacy organization at NPR that has really been born in radio. We have digital efforts. The radio listening in this country has been declining for 29 straight years, and it's declined for the next 29 straight years. And everyone who sits in various seats in news organizations have to think about sort of the news customer of the future, how you see yourself getting content, how you see yourselves not as passive observers, but really part of the conversation that news has become. So I'm really delighted to be here and really interested to hear not only your questions about sort of what's going on in American journalism, but actually how you think about journalism, how it needs to change, and how you see it changing in the future. So Jim, thank you for having me here, and love to hear your questions and thoughts on the subject. Yes, sir.
My name's Graham. I was actually a reporter for a building listed in the paper before law school. Yeah. And I don't think I share your pessimism in terms of news demand. I think the average consumer wants more news than ever before.
Yep.
In the industry. And so what I think might be important, tell me if you agree, would be figuring out ways to monetize an individual's efforts so that it could exist outside the corporate structure of media. And is that something that you're working on? How do you see that developing? Yeah. So that an individual blogger would have the incentive to go to City Hall.
Yeah. So it's an interesting point. I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's no question now that news consumption is much higher than it's ever been. I mean, there are actually so many more opportunities to engage in the news. I mean, it seems totally unthinkable of a world, which was not so long ago that you had to wait till 6 o'clock news to understand what's going on in the world. And there's no question that people are use news content much more than they did. I mean, this is my illustration about the New York Times. I reported from the New York Times 4 years ago, and really a snap of the finger in sort of a historical arc. Their principal customers were 900,000 print edition readers. Their principal customer now 14 million online readers. And the ability to multi-source, to find, to jump between different sources from radio, television, to online, much higher. So I don't think there's any question about the demand. And where there's demand, I think there will be answers to the economic questions. What I think you're seeing right now, so I think the reality right now is almost a conflictual situation of much greater use of news content from those who actually are still in the news business, but fewer ways to monetize it because of sort of the death of traditional advertising. And that has led to sort of this almost sort of downward spiral. I mean, it leads to a downward spiral of newspapers having to, because of the need to meet their market for Wall Street, cutting their newsrooms, which leads to declining quality, which means people looking for alternatives, which means you cut the newsrooms more. And I think, to your point, I think alternatives will arise. I don't know what they will be. I mean, the bloggers, I know very few bloggers or alternative voices in sort of digital plays that actually have made any sort of financial returns of significance. Most people who blog or involve themselves in citizen journalism do it out of a sense of sort of, I think, civic involvement, desire to have a voice, rather than sense that there is, other than some niches, that there is a economic benefit to them or a full-time occupation. And I think that's the challenge to me, is the models have not occurred to allow people to sort of professionalize themselves. I mean, there is, anyone can be a reporter. It's not rocket science, but there is an art and value chain to the idea of being out reporting, collecting sources, multiple sources, having to come back and having professional editors review, challenge, push you. I mean, you had that experience yourself. And that is a method of doing journalism that doesn't seem to have any economic support right now. And I don't necessarily see that changing anytime in the near future.
Yes. Along those lines, you kind of touched on the idea that newspapers or sources are becoming increasingly political or less perhaps objective than they were throughout most of the 20th century. I'm wondering if blogs really take off as the replacement for traditional news sources, then do you see sort of what's happening with Wikipedia, where sort of the community as a whole releases the message and makes sure that it's not one way or the other?
Yeah, so I think the overall, the way I look at it is facts are expensive, opinions are cheap. And I think that's really what's happened in the world, which is easy to fill up, it's hard to fill up 24 hours of time on cable network with actual reporters. It's easy to have, as CNN did on election night, along with their holograms, you know, their panel of experts and their panel of partisans. It's a small booking exercise and relatively easy to do. So I think, will the community, I think that the question is, I think that the question about sort of the community policing the gathering of facts is a little bit hard, only because no one's gathering the facts anymore. It is enormously expensive to do investigative journalism. It's enormously expensive to have, and I'll tell you some of the sort of the means I had at NPR. It's enormously expensive to, as we did at NPR, to have 17 foreign journalists. It's enormously expensive and dangerous to have reporters in Iraq. And you can't expect to have an informed public, regardless of whether the community is policing or not, if you're not willing to make that investment. The task of reporting from Iraq is not just about having a reporter there, it's also about having bulletproof vehicles, it's about having connectivity and security, and those things are enormously expensive and fewer people are doing it. And the investigative journalism, I remember, one of my first meetings at NPR 10 years ago when the newsroom told me that they wanted to take one of the hosts off the show and put him, Danny Zwerdlin in this case, and put him on doing investigative journalism. And they wanted to take him off for 6 months, and eventually did it, and actually did a lot. He did a couple years ago an extraordinary series of reporting on soldiers coming home from Iraq with PTSD and how they were treated by the returning military. And it actually was some of the best reporting I ever heard, not just because he reported sort of the challenges that these soldiers had, but also the views of the sergeants who actually had the prospects of building a team and sending that team back into combat and how they sort of viewed that. It took them about 9 months, him and a producer full-time for 9 months, and he produced 10 minutes of content. The best 10 minutes of radio you'd ever want to hear, but that left another, about 22 hours and 50 minutes worth of content for us to produce that work. And you got to really care about journalism, you've got to make that investment. And nothing that I see happening in the web or in the digital world is a substitute for that. And that's really sort of, I'm a huge user and fan of Wikipedia, and I do think actually that wiki technology is actually going to be very important in sort of news production over time. But what I worry about is not a substitute for that professional core who really do spend the time and investment in reporting from overseas and investing in journalism and holding government to their promises and to their accountabilities.
I feel like there are maybe two kind of major directions that some of the established media have tried to go for the big result problem. You're trying to go toward the more community journalism focus on the hyperlocal, or you go in a news aggregation direction where you've got a bunch of content in one place. Which basket do you feel like is maybe the best place to put their money right now? And I guess you'll have a preference. How do you feel like those interact going forward?
Yeah, it's there are a lot of. I mean, this is actually sort of, as I sort of whine and moan at you about sort of the state of American journalism, it's actually the most interesting time as well, because there's actually so many opportunities to do different things. And to your point about sort of aggregation, I think about something like Real Clear Politics, which I assume a lot of you used during the course of the year, which no one had ever heard of a year ago, and then became sort of, and they don't really, to those of you who don't know, Real Clear Politics came sort of over a course of a year, the place where you go to really find out what's going on. And it's actually sort of remarkably low impact adventure because they didn't actually do any reporting. In fact, as far as I can tell, they put nothing in the graphics. All they did was actually be really good at going out and finding out what others were reporting and bringing it together and creating that sort of one-stop shopping for people. And I think there is, to my mind, actually a lot of power and impact on helping people find out sort of navigate this enormous range of information that is out there. And I've often looked at, when I was at NPR and since then, at sort of doing things that help people sort of navigate and find this sort of wild mass of information that's the web. So I think there is real power in aggregation, as long as someone's still out there doing some of the reporting. Because if no one's doing the reporting, you can't really not much left to aggregate. The hyper-local element, I think, is also interesting. I think it's actually faced a lot of financial challenges. Those who are doing hyper-local have, from what I can tell, done fairly poorly in this environment. But I think hyper-local is going to end up being the most interesting examples of sort of citizen journalism that there is out there, because no one cares. I live in a part of Washington called Mount Pleasant. No one outside of this nine square block area cares about what goes on in Mount Pleasant. I can think of two articles in the last year that have been in the Washington Post about Mount Pleasant, with no sort of reporting on things that want a fire and want a murder. Come on to Mount Pleasant; it's a great place to live. But no follow-up, and no one other than the people of that community really care. And I think there will be mechanisms for people to sort of develop. And I think there is going to be a future in sort of how the citizens of that nine square block report to each other about what's going on, and create sort of a sense of community that I think information is really the foundation of. Does that answer your question? You're getting more credit than I deserve. Thank you.
If I were to do that, I would see a report, during the campaign of following Barack Obama around on the campaign plane, which is very expensive and really doesn't tell me that much at the end of the day. But if I go to something like Talking Points Memo, I can see, an in-depth discussion of what's happening in Alaska corruption trials, or Alaska corruption in general. And I wonder, what is happening from the mainstream media to reconsider how they're reporting, because that's just not of interest and it's not.
Yeah, I think that's actually, I think this is sort of how the mainstream media thinks about the changing times and changing opportunities. It's actually a lesson in sort of the calcification of businesses. It is very hard at mainstream media organizations to sort of change the way they do business. The 6 o'clock news, for all intents and purposes, not very different the way it was 20 years ago. I mean, if you watch Lair or you watch CBS or ABC or NBC, they're really not very different, even though the entire sort of customer experience is different. I mean, people have spent their whole day on the web. They know what's already happened. There's a different service to be had at 6 o'clock. I actually think mainstream media, which I'm a happy representative of, is doing a terrible job of rethinking their service and what can be done. And that's why sort of the digital insurgents are doing so much better than the mainstream media, in terms of actually aggregating audiences, doing new and interesting things, all the things, many of the things that places like Talking Points and others are doing, are things that actually the CNNs of the world actually had the opportunity to do, but didn't do it because it doesn't fit into sort of the existing culture and existing bureaucracy. So I think the mainstream media is actually going to be sort of fall further and further behind over the years, and I think it's no accident you don't watch the 6 o'clock news, because it really is built upon a model of information that is dying and will be dead within a few years. I think that's a sad moment, because I don't think people are necessarily replacing the 6 o'clock news with entirely substitute services, but I don't see the mainstream media changing fast enough to truly meet the needs of the audience. Yes,
sir. You talk about the shift in the New York Times from newspaper to online. If people look at a very, so the volume is increasing significantly. So if people looked at, you know, 1 cent per click per average per article, as opposed to like, this like New York Times, I mean, Wall Street Journal, like, I don't know what it is a month.
Right.
But something where instead of, you know, you have such large volumes, why not monetize it with lower costs, where I would pay like $30 and have an account, and then all of a sudden I have to be accessing 3,000 clicks within your sites. And people looked at that and just get over it.
Yeah, I think I've actually talked with the Times specifically about sort of different subscription models, sort of the monthly fee that the Wall Street Journal does, which has been sort of roundly critiqued over the years, I think almost sort of the tip jar thing that, you know, support the New York Times, to I think sort of usage, some almost sort of usage fees, and I think most people remain convinced that any charges, there's so many different choices out there that any charges will be enough to sort of turn the audience away. I mean, if you remember, the Times tried something called Times Select, which was not a pay-per-click, but it was, they gated their sort of, you know, some of the columnists, Friedman and others, and you had to pay. Everything else was free except some of their sort of most prominent writers. It didn't work. I mean, there was just so little uptake on it, far below what they projected, that they went back to it. They figured that, man, they could support it better with ads. And I think, you know, the challenge is, you know, the ad dollars for the internet is fixed, and there are just so many different choices where the an advertiser can put their dollars. And they start with Google, they start Yahoo, and they don't get down to the newspapers and other content providers to weigh down sort of that value chain. So I don't think they've found, I don't think anyone sort of discovered the right way of monetizing that, you know, what is a fairly important public service. Yes?
First, I apologize
because
I have to run out to
go
to class. Sorry,
sorry,
can't sorry for the future interruption. But also, earlier in your talk...
I'm not going to answer your question, sorry.
Earlier in your talk, you were saying, you know, one way you can sort of see media going is through a nonprofit kind of NPR type model.
Yeah.
It seems to me now that mainstream media has gotten increasingly partisan. You know, New York Times is a liberal rag, Wall Street Journal is conservative, MSNBC is really liberal, Fox News is ridiculously conservative.
Do you really think that? Was that just sort of the
I think.
I mean, you think sort of Fox is one side and the New York Times is another?
I think, to some extent, yes. I don't personally think everything is as one-sided as I think it is presented.
But I
sort of self-select what I look at online and listen to and read, based in part on what my perception of their meanings are, or what I think is more objective and what I think is more subjective. But I wonder sort of how moving things to a nonprofit model, if you think that would sort of increase the partisanship, because your nonprofits could then potentially have a goal, a mission of promoting a particular viewpoint, whereas now, at least nominally, these for-profit organizations are presenting a fair and balanced view.
So let me say a couple things, which is, so I actually, and so you have to touch the chord with me. Get out. I spent 9 years at NPR sort of answering questions about liberal bias. And I've always very polite about it. Now that I've left NPR, I don't have to be polite about it anymore. I think at some level there is some justification for charges of bias. I mean, we're all people. We all have political views. I'm sure if you go into almost any newsroom in the country and sort of look at people's voter registration cards, 90% of them will be Democrats. And that has some consequences for story selection, has some consequences for what the editor decides is important. There's no question about it. But I think there is absolutely no correlation equivalency between what the New York Times does and sort of some subconscious effect on it of sort of what reporters think and care about. That is a news organization that spends a lot of time trying to make things, to steal a phrase, fair and balanced. And they bend over backwards. I know, you know, so news, high-quality newsrooms spend a lot of time. It is always the first rough draft of history. It's not a perfect enterprise, but they spend a lot of time trying to make sure the views from other sides get in. And there's no equivalency between that. There's no analogy in my mind between that, say Fox News, or MSNBC on the other side. I mean, Oberman is a polemicist. O'Reilly is a polemicist. They're not journalists. The fact that, and always sickened me. That's probably the problem. Always pissed me off. When people talk about sort of Fox News on one side or NPR on the New York Times on the other, because it's really very different enterprises with very different qualities and ideals below them. And it's not even intended to be a critique of Fox or Oberman. There is room in the public discourse for polemicists, going back to Thomas Paine, you know, but it's very different from the art and craft of journalism. And the only thing that really annoys me about those guys is when they claim to be journalists, because they're not. They're advocates. My experience, not actually answer your question, I haven't gotten that off my chest. I think it's an interesting question which I actually hadn't contemplated, and you may be right, but I will tell you my experience coming from a nonprofit. The nonprofits respond sort of to the articulated mission of the organization, of the purpose of which they've been founded. And that could be an advocacy. So I think there's certainly, you could see the Sierra Club deciding that it wanted to produce on a daily basis the environmental reporting of record. And it would certainly have, you would expect naturally have a slant reflective of the views of the Sierra Club and the position of the Sierra Club. So I think that is certainly one consequence of the evolution of media, and one possibility of it. But I come from an organization, you know, whose founding doctrine, so the DNA of the organization is journalism as straightforward and pure as simple as possible. And that's true for NPR, it's true for the St. Petersburg Times, which happens to be a nonprofit. It's true, I think, for the handful of nonprofits that have come up so far, the Center for Public Integrity. Others who really see who are mission-based organizations see their mission as the art and crafts of journalism. And the question really is there enough financial support out there in the philanthropic community for that type of, for journalism, as opposed to issue advocacy, which there's probably a bigger pot of money for.
Yes. And I think a lot of people get the one about class, which is probably a wrap up.